Vladimir Putin is just a simple person, and it's really important to understand what he's made of. Usually, he's considered to be a person with KGB background, and KGB explains it all. He's like a dark knight of Soviet secret security services. But that's not true. He was not a super spy. He was not a Soviet James Bond. He was very mediocre officer. He was not a spy. He was working in GDR, even more in the city of Dresden, as the director of a cultural center. So that was not an important mission.
What is going on, guys? Before kicking off the podcast, I just want to say that if you guys do enjoy, please do me a huge favor and leave the podcast a 5-star review if you're listening on Spotify or Apple Music, or if you're on YouTube, like and subscribe for more weekly podcasts. Today we speak with Mikhail Zager on his new book, War and Punishment. Mikhail is a Russian journalist willing to stand toe-to-toe with Russian leaders like Vladimir Putin, and in his book, he reviews the history of Russia and Ukraine and reflects on how it led to the invasion we see today. He is known and loved by many Russians for starting one of the only opposition news stations in Russia that, before being forcibly shut down, provided the people with the truth. So if you enjoy, please do check out War and Punishment, as well as some of his other books. And with that, let's hear what Mikhail said to Putin and Russia in regards to the Ukraine war. The war in Ukraine is shameful. It is our shame. But unfortunately, our children, as well as generations of infants and still unborn Russians, will also have to bear responsibility for it. We do not want our children to live in an aggressor country, to be ashamed of their army attacking a neighboring independent state. We call upon all citizens of Russia to say no to this war. Mikhail Zager, I'm extremely excited to have you on today. And as many people probably already know from some of the introductions to this podcast, that was an open letter speaking on the Russian-Ukraine war. So just to start off on the top, what inspired you to write that open letter, and what made it such an important and critical time for you to be able to reach out to the people of Russia and the people around the world and let them know to say no to the Ukraine war?
Thank you, Reid. That's a good question. Just let's imagine that we wake up one day and you wake up one day and you realize that there is a total catastrophe, that that you have lost everything you were planning to do, everything you were dreaming of, and actually any kind of future you were hoping for is not available anymore. It's over. So that was the feeling I guess everyone felt on the morning of February 24th, 2022. That was an extraordinary feeling that the country we lived in turned into a fascist state, into a fascist regime, and it started the brutal aggression against innocent civilians. So, first of all, like for first hour or 2 hours, probably most of us didn't know what to do and what is it. Are we still capable to do anything? The first thing that came up to my mind was that I need to write something, because like I'm a writer. Probably the first thing I should do is to speak out, is to express my opinion. It was hard to write, but to write anything long. So I thought that like 2 paragraphs would be enough for many people, for thousands of people, for millions of people to read. And I called several my colleagues, my friends, prominent Russian writers, filmmakers, artists, and they very quickly co-signed this letter. We published it immediately, and it was then reposted by hundreds of thousands of people within. They were sharing it on their social media, and I think that the response from the authorities it was very impressive, and that's why the response from the authorities was very swift. Within just 2 days, they announced that actually they introduced the military censorship in Russia, so it was forbidden to to call this war a war. It should have been called the special military operation. And any kind of denouncement of this war, any kind of point of view contradicting the official statement of the military of the Ministry of Defense was equalized to treason and would be punished by imprisonment. So it was. I realized that that was the first initial step I was supposed to do, and it was probably in a way effective, but not effective enough, not actually meaningless. We could not stop the war, and we failed to prevent this war as Russian civil society, and we cannot stop it right now.
I will say, though, I don't think failure is the right word, because people like you bringing out your voice and being able to speak to what is happening and give such a realistic perspective to the Russian people and to people around the world is critical in times like this. And I've had an opportunity with my platform to work to really push forward voices like that. So to start off with that, thank you for doing what you do. From there, I really want to speak about this Russian fascism, which is something that you highlight in the new book, War and Punishment, and essentially go through the history of the relationship with Russia, Ukraine, and the local region, and how there has been a developing cycle of what we've seen, something similar to Russian fascism. So do you want to speak to, I guess, the characteristics of Russian fascism and how historically we have led to the invasion of Ukraine?
We were very naive. If we were speaking with you 2 years ago, and you would use the phrase Russian fascism, I might have been furious, and I might have started arguing with you, saying that what Russian fascism? What are you talking about? And actually, everything changed when the war started. Probably for us, for many people outside of Russia, for many Ukrainians, for many people who live in neighboring countries, they were using the same phrase for many years, and they are now surprised why Russians are awakened only now, why they hadn't noticed that before. But yeah, for us that was a wake up call, and we really underestimated, and we were blind to see how brutal was Russian Empire during the last centuries. If we analyze the current situation, I would say that we had that turning point for Russian fascism to start being popularized by Russian propaganda and by Russian authorities, by President Putin. And that was year 2011, 2012, when there were huge protest rallies against President Putin, and a lot of Russians, like millions of people in Russia's biggest cities, were openly protesting, and they didn't want him to run again for another presidential term. And that was a huge psychological blow for him, because he expected Russian middle class to be loyal for him. He thought that most Russians should have been thankful for him for the most prosperous decade in Russian history. But on the contrary, he saw that the most educated, the most successful, the most intellectual Russians hate him. They want him out, and for him that was that turning point. He realized that he cannot rely on the middle class. He must rely on other people, on other audience, on probably less educated, probably more nationalistic. So that was the moment when Russian propaganda adopted all the terrible schemes. They started promoting the idea of Russian nationalism, of Russian exceptionalism. They started promoting the idea that Russia should be great again. And should become a buyer again. If Russia, if a lot of people in this world are scared of Russia, that would mean that Russia is a great country. Yes, we had witnessed the 10 years of that hardcore promotion of those fascist ideas. And here we come. By the beginning of 2022, a lot of people were ready to accept this war. So that's the shortest history of the development of Russian fascism during the last decade, but definitely is deeply rooted in Russian history and in the way how Russian history was written by classical Russian historians during the recent centuries.
And we oftentimes hear of Putin's national vision of a grand plan, as you were just highlighting there, it's oftentimes this idea of making Russia great again. How much do you boil that down to Putin's own personal ambitions, whether that's to historically down the road be looked at as some of these other Russian historical figures that are mythological in a sense? Or is it more of a power preservation? Or is there a feeling throughout the country, as you were speaking there, that people want this idea of making Russia great again?
No, I think that it's much more about power preservation. And he was not trying to exploit all those feelings, and he was not trying to use nostalgia during the first years of his presidency. Probably year 2004 was very important one, because that was the year when Orange Revolution happened in Ukraine, and that was a huge embarrassment for President Putin, because he really invested a lot of effort and a lot of money to support pro-Kremlin candidate Viktor Yanukovych, and it was all in vain. Pro-Kremlin candidate was defeated, and probably the most important reason was that all those Russian spin doctors, all those political technologists that were working for pro-Kremlin candidate in Ukraine, they were just stealing the money. They were ineffective. They did not believe in what they were doing, but they had to report to Putin about the reasons for their failure, and they explained it all. They said that the reasons are the Americans. It was not because we stole all the budget. No, Americans paid much more. Americans invested in their pro-Western candidate much more than we did. And that's ridiculous explanation, but Putin bought it. And Putin started believing that there is a huge American conspiracy against him, and Ukraine was just the first stop. And the real aim is Russia. He started believing that Americans, President George W. Bush wants to overthrow him, wants to organize that kind of Orange Revolution in Russia. And yeah, that was the beginning of his paranoia. He started being more and more anti-Western, more and more imperialistic, and he started one of his right-hand men, his pocket ideologist named Vladislav Surkov, created the concept of Russia as a besieged fortress. So yeah, he felt that only being only living in a fortress, only living in a fortified tsardom, he can be safe, and that's why he needs to mobilize the whole nation. He needs to prove to everyone that Russia should be the empire that is fighting against the West.
One of the brilliant aspects of your book is the way that you approach telling these different periods in history, and not just reflecting on it as something in the past, but in many ways writing it as if it was occurring now, and often humanizing these characters that throughout history are mythologized and oftentimes looked at in a whole different light, whether that's good, bad, ugly, whatever it might be. But humanizing these characters is critical. Could you humanize Putin, including the good, the bad, and the ugly, and reflect on how the modern day Putin that we see now is different than what this mythological supervillain, but also for some hero, has kind of changed?
Oh, you know, I think that it's really important to think of everyone as just a human being. And that's why I'm writing about the heroes from 17th century or 18th century in present tense, because that brings them closer to us. We need to feel that they were not bronze monuments and they were not wax figures from Madame Tussauds Museum. They were human beings made of flesh and bones, as well as Vladimir Putin is just a simple person. And it's really important to understand what he's made of. He's considered to be a person with KGB background, and like KGB explains it all. He's like a dark knight of Soviet secret security services, but that's not true. He was not a super spy. He was not a Soviet James Bond. He was very mediocre officer. He was not a spy. He was working in GDR, even more in city of Dresden, as the director of a cultural center. So that was not an important mission. Dresden was not important city in former GDR, and so no really important assignment was ever in hands of Vladimir Putin. But even more important that during 90s, after the collapse of Soviet Union, Vladimir Putin was working in St. Petersburg. He was deputy mayor of this, Russia's second biggest cities, the city. And during that period, he was very closely in touch with so-called Russian mafia. He was really connected with the gangsters of St. Petersburg. Actually, St. Petersburg in the 90s had a very vicious reputation in Russia. That was considered to be some kind of gangster capital of Russia, because that was very important port for all exports and for imports as well. It was exporting aluminium or importing tobacco and alcohol, and it was Putin who was in charge of all those contracts. He was really connected to gangster leaders of 90s, and that shaped his psychology a great deal. So he's a very he's a human being with very mixed, very troubled background. He never expected to become a political leader, and he never wanted to run for office. And I think all those details are very important. So it's not about humanizing of Vladimir Putin. It's about human psychology, because I'm deeply persuaded that he is, unfortunately, usually demonized or idealized by the Western media. He is considered to be a genius, strategist, but he's not. He's not a chess player. He is much more of a surfer. He's very good in tactics. He is sometimes responding quickly. He used to be, and now he has changed a lot. He has changed after COVID. He was really isolated for many months, and he cut his ties with a lot of sources of information he used to have. He spent several months together with his old pal, most influential Russian oligarch Yuri Kovalchuk. So he's not that bright strategist as he was always considered by Western media.
Let's dive into that COVID timeline a little bit more too, because I think you highlighted that beautifully within the book and articles and other podcasts that I've listened to. And I do have the names written down. Just wanted to make sure I was able to pronounce them correct. But so Yuri Kovalchuk and Andrei Frisenko. So both of them were isolated with Putin and had a dramatic effect on his psyche. Can you speak to that a little bit and why the COVID timeline in many ways was kind of an important development in, you know, what we saw in 2021, as well as just the general development of Putin and his psyche?
I must correct you. He was together with Kovalchuk only. Voroshenko was not there. But you're right. Those two men are very important for Putin because they are close friends since 90s. And you may imagine a person from very humble and very poor family, but raised in St. Petersburg, comes back from GDR to the collapsed Soviet Union. And he is a deputy mayor, and he meets two guys from very privileged families, Kovalchuk and Voroshenko. Their fathers are renowned Soviet academicians. They're very famous historians, intellectuals. And Vladimir Putin wanted to be closer to them. They were very important figures for him. They were kind of moral authorities because they were obviously much more privileged, much more successful than his father was. And those two historians played a very crucial role in shaping of Putin's personality and in shaping of his approach to Russian history. And there is a huge irony that there's What topics were they specializing in? Kovalchuk, the singer, was specializing in the history of Crimea and city of Sebastopol, that is the main, the most important Russian naval base in Crimea. And Voroshenko, the singer, was specializing in history of the United States and especially the Cold War. So he was writing books about American conspiracy and CIA-led conspiracy against Soviet Union. So no wonder why they shaped his approach to global politics in this way. And it was especially interesting that back in 2014, when Putin decided to occupy Crimea, that was a shock, that was a surprise for many Russians, because there was no popular demand. That was not an issue discussed by many Russians for years. No one considered Crimea to be cradle of Russian civilization, to be a sacred territory that needed to be brought back home. It was that idea was not shared by many people. That's why it was so surprising that was Putin's personal belief, and now we know the reason for that. That's because of the personal influence of academician Kovalchuk.
So let's cycle to the other end of the aisle with Ukraine and Zelensky. I think the human psychological aspect, as you were just highlighting, the development of Putin from the 80s to the 90s and so on, is incredibly interesting and insightful in understanding these leaders. We have someone on Ukraine, the current leader, who had to step up at a time when his country was being invaded, who was originally a comedian, was playing the president on TV, and now suddenly finds himself in many ways in front of the entire world, standing against Russia in one of the most violent conflicts we've seen in the modern day. So how do you think Zelensky has developed over the years working with and against Russia, and how do you think that reflects on who we see today?
Yeah, it was very interesting for me just to follow his life. I was interviewing his childhood friends, his partners in business, other actors who were working with him in the film industry, and he has really made a very an enormous development, an enormous way, starting as a participant of a very popular TV show, very popular TV show on Russian television. It's very funny to see how different his humor used to be 20 years ago, because all the jokes he could afford himself would seem completely inappropriate and very insulting for Ukraine today. So it's just watching how Zelensky's humor has changed, it's clear that Ukraine as a nation has changed completely. That during all those years, the feeling of national pride and national identity has changed a lot. And many Ukrainians could not say that Ukraine was a Soviet colony 30 years ago. They did not consider themselves to be colonized because they were under great Soviet influence, and almost the whole country was 100% Russified. There was Russian television, Russian culture dominating everywhere. And that's why many Ukrainians considered themselves to be not so bright, not so talented, not so deserving to have a bigger place. And actually, the maximum they could dream of was going to Moscow and achieving some success on Russian television. And during the 90s, that situation started changing, and it's clear that Vladimir Zelensky might represent very, very good symbol of that development, because in year 2003, just 1 year before the Orange Revolution, he made his personal choice. He decided to quit Russian television, to leave Moscow, and he came back to Ukraine because he believed that he belongs there. He should work for Ukrainian audience. He should work for Ukrainian television, and it was not a political choice. It was not. It was just a coincidence that the same time Ukrainian Orange Revolution happened, and Ukraine as a nation made the same choice. They wanted to be an independent nation. They wanted to be a liberal, democratic, European nation. And it's very symbolic that as a president, Vladimir Zelensky represents the third generation of Ukrainian politicians, because when Soviet Union collapsed, the first presidents of Ukraine were obviously former members of Communist Party, and they spent most of their lives living in Soviet Union, being members of Communist Party. Then that generation changed, and here we had the second generation, former members of Soviet Komsomol. Komsomol is Young Communist League. It was just a huge youth organization in the Soviet Union, and several consecutive presidents of Ukraine who were not members of Communist Party because they were young enough, but they were members of Komsomol. So Zelensky is the third generation. He didn't spend most of his life in Soviet Union. He doesn't associate himself with the Soviet regime, with Communist Party, or even with Komsomol. He doesn't share any Soviet prejudice. He doesn't view Ukraine as Soviet colony, and that's very symbolic. He represents the population of Ukraine today. He is purely a symbol of that dignity of Ukrainian nation. On the contrary, I must admit that in Russia we still have the first generation. We still have communists, because Vladimir Putin used to be a member of Communist Party, and actually most of his life still, even 30 years after collapse of the Soviet Union, most of his life he spent as a member of Communist Party.
Yeah, I was just about to ask that is still something you're seeing in Russia. Are you seeing a generation shift, though? I mean, in many ways in the U.S., our comparison would be maybe some of the more conservative politics pushing towards a more progressive mindset, you know, across the population. Do you see something similar with pushing away that a lot of the Soviet culture aspects that maybe were ingrained in some of the older generations in Russia as well? Or are the younger generations still finding themselves, at least in a few ways, attached?
You know, I was much more optimistic 10 years ago, because 10 years ago, as I've already mentioned, there were huge protest rallies in Russia. And that time I was running Russia's most influential independent news TV channel, oppositional news TV channel. And I was absolutely sure that we were prevailing. I was sure that the majority is on our side, that all young Russians, they do not share that that Soviet stereotypes, and they want Russia to be more than democratic. And that was obvious. When we looked at all those protest rallies, we saw those bright young faces that didn't want any kind of dictatorship. So I was really optimistic. What happened next didn't break my faith, but at the same time we have all reasons to be worried, because we have witnessed 10 years of terrible brainwashing, younger people are not watching television. They are less influenced by propaganda, by the brainwashing, but definitely there are consequences, and definitely a lot of people they don't share Soviet prejudice. For example, I know that although there is a stereotype that Russian society is very homophobic, I know that it's not, because last year when I came out and married my longtime partner, and we were cursed by Russian propaganda. We made all the headlines and all the propagandist TV channels, but it meant nothing. We received only best wishes from ordinary Russians. We received thousands of congratulations from all parts of Russia, from all different people, and it was clear. For me, that was a very clear proof that actually for younger people, they just don't get it. They just are not into that homophobic old Soviet prejudice. But still, in some ways, in terms of Russia against the West, in terms of the geopolitical prejudice, if propaganda works, it works there. So I think that might be the most serious consequence of Putin's propaganda. So even after he leaves, he would leave Russia with a lot of even younger brainwashed people who would believe that Russia is doomed to fight against the West, that the West hates Russia, and even more, they might think that it wasn't Russia that attacked Ukraine, but actually the war was initiated by the United States, and Ukraine was used only as a proxy.
So you spoke about your past running one of the largest media oppositions in Russia, and very successful, and something that is critical in any country, but one especially with heavy propaganda is even more critical. Can you speak to, one, what inspired you to start that journey, you know, many years ago, as well as what were some of the difficulties and challenges that you ran up against facing such a overwhelming force of propaganda?
You know, I think that was easy. That was very easy to start, because we were young and bold and very naive. We didn't know that we were not allowed to start that. We didn't ask Kremlin for the permission, and that's why no one prohibited us from starting that TV channel. And very soon we realized that we are very needed. There was a huge demand for that type of news television. I would always argue with international journalists, with American journalists who told me that you are as oppositional TV channel, and I would say, no, we are not oppositional. We are normal television. Others are propagandists, and we are normal. We are doing our job. We are covering all the important news. We give floor to representatives of the opposition as well as the government. We had all the ministers. We had that time president of Russia was Dmitry Medvedev, and we interviewed president. We were normal. At the same time, we were covering all the protest rallies. We were making our anti-corruption investigations. So we were doing a very good job, and it was very exciting for me when I started as an editor-in-chief. I started receiving lots of letters from very distant Russian provinces, and ordinary people were complaining for their bureaucrats, for their local authorities, and they were asking me to start an investigation and like to find out the truth about their local chief. And it meant a lot, because they knew that they could trust us. They couldn't trust their local authorities. They could trust us. That was a very, very good start, and we had bright perspectives. By 2014, we had as much as 20 million households watching us daily. So it's only daily statistics. But unfortunately, the TV channel was almost destroyed in the beginning of 2014. That happened approximately 1 month before the Crimea occupation. It was very very tricky pre-orchestrated campaign, and all the cable and satellite networks dropped us within 1 week, and we lost more than 99% of our audience, and continued working only as an online TV channel, but I must say that TV channel still works now, not from Russia, but from Amsterdam, and it's still needed by a lot of Russians. So speaking, if Russians need the truth, if they want to know it, or if they know what's really happening, yes, they do. The recent statistics for online TV channel that is broadcasting only via YouTube is approximately 20 million unique users per month. And out of those 20 million, 13 million are inside of Russia, Russians in Russia, and 7 million are Russians outside of the country.
And did you guys ever feel threatened, either from the government or even the people that maybe bought into the propaganda? We see that sometimes in the U.S. people get so infatuated with whatever it is that their mindset is set, that they'll threaten journalists or whatever it might be. So did you guys ever have those type of threats, either from the government or from some Russian people themselves?
Yeah, obviously. Russian society is very polarized, and it is becoming more and more polarized these days during the war. We had a very negative experience back during the scandal that was used as a pretext to destroy the TV channel, and especially when Crimea occupations started, we were hated by some part of Russian population, of some part of our audience, because we were viewed as a traitors. They also called us fascists, because that's a long time Russian tradition to call fascist anyone who is against you. And yes, after the war, I quit working for that TV channel several years ago. So I'm no longer editor in chief. But the TV channel had to stop broadcasting from Russia on the fifth day of the war because of the military censorship, and because it was forbidden to call the war a war. All the journalists had. Almost all the journalists had to leave Russia and relocate to Latvia and then to Netherlands. But yes, we definitely. It's not safe in Russia. Not only because you might be prosecuted by by the authorities, but also because there are people who are really some of them are brainwashed, some of them are true believers. But I guess that, as in any country, this is a very tiny minority. The most ardent and the most noisy activists are always very tiny minority.
So you did leave Moscow and move to Berlin, and I know currently you're within the U.S. and you're obviously moving around all the time with such a busy schedule and, you know, journalist opportunity. What was the mindset for leaving Moscow, both what created that decision and what was the feelings as you were, you know, stepping aboard that plane, that train, whatever you might have taken to leave the country at that point?
You know, I've already told you that I had a feeling of a wake-up call, and I was thinking that probably if we were fighting the regime for so many years, and now it has won, but it's obviously prevailing, that probably everything we have done was not enough, and we should start over. We should do something different. I was trying to figure out what else should I do, and as we see, Putin is always using history as the most important part of his propaganda. He's trying to justify this war with some historical examples. He loves lecturing Russians about his vision on Russian history, and I'm 100% convinced that I know that his version of Russian history is falsified, and even more, I came to the conclusion that actually we had never had any kind of normal, decent history of Russian peoples. We had only history of Russian Empire. It has always been written by propagandists, by the official historians who were serving the state and whose only objective was to prove that the empire is the only and the biggest value, and everything that Russians are doing should be done for the sake of great victories of Russian Empire. So I found out that probably the basis of our ideology, the basis of our approach to ourselves and to our history, to our culture, is very shaky. It was always wrong. So I have a new goal. I have a new mission. I think that I have to write another version of Russian history. I have to create completely different historical narrative that would be non-imperialistic, that would care about peoples, not about those in power, that would respect Russian the society and as well as peoples of surrounding countries, of neighboring countries that were occupied by Russian Empire during the previous centuries. We do need the history that is not focused on Moscow, because it has always been very unfair, and that was a stereotype shared not only by Russian historians but by Western historians as well. The history was always focused on Moscow and even more on rulers of Moscow. That's the vicious circle that must be broken.
So speaking of the human and people aspect of this war, you speak about Nadia within the book and how this war changed a lot of the dynamics within your guys' relationship and also led you to reflecting on some of the changes in the human relationships that are happening between Ukraine, Russia, and the greater world. So can you reflect on that relationship with Nadia and some of the words that went back and forth and essentially how that kind of pushed your mindset into wanting to look at this from a whole different angle?
Yeah, absolutely. Nadia is a friend of mine, or used to be a friend of mine, almost a relative. And as I was coming to Kyiv regularly during the last 20 years, I was working a lot. I was covering most of major Ukrainian political crisis, all the revolutions. Sometimes I was staying at her house, and even more, I happened to write a huge part of my previous book called The Kremlin's Man in her house, that is located in a very nice suburb of Kiev. Now its name is known worldwide. It's called Bucha. That time it was just a very peaceful suburb. Now it has become a symbol of the brutality of Russian soldiers who organized the massacre there. Fortunately, Nadia with her child managed to leave Bucha before the beginning of Russian aggression, but she stopped speaking to me after the beginning of the war. As for many Ukrainians, it's very hard to speak to Russians, even no matter what's their political position. That's very understandable emotional approach when they cannot differentiate, they cannot divide the nationality and the personal position. They put blame for Russia's crime to their Russian friends as well. I will never argue this approach. I will never argue any Ukrainian until the war is over. I fully understand all those feelings of Ukrainians, but still, I wanted to talk to Nadia with this book, and as I know from her friends, she's blaming me for being Russian imperialist, as all Russians. I think that's a very important topic. That's really important that we should not try to prove that we are innocent. We should confess that we are guilty. And when Ukrainians blame us, we must say yes. And we should take the blame. We should take the responsibility. And we should try to revise our past. We should reconsider everything we have done and what Russian culture has done before. So we should find our sins. We should confess. We should just make that work to never let it happen again. And probably there is worth mentioning one very important debate that's going on between Russians and Ukrainians. Many Ukrainians put blame on Russian culture as such. They say that Russian literature has always been imperialistic. And Pushkin or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or other Russian writers and thinkers were Russian imperialists, so they should be boycotted, or they should be blamed as well as Russian propagandists today. But at the same time, many Russian liberals answer saying, no, don't touch Pushkin, don't touch great Russian literature, they are not to blame. And I think this approach is very short-sighted, and we should not be so apologetic. We should take the blame, we should find, we should understand that all those great writers were human beings as well. They committed mistakes. Pushkin wrote some terrible things about Ukraine. Dostoevsky had very nationalistic views. Actually, he thought that Turkey should not exist as a country, and he wanted Constantinople to be the capital of Russian Empire. And we should not pretend that it never happened. We should know. All our real history, it's not a shame. It's an obligation for us. And I think we are not the first ones to do that job. I love the example of Kipling, who is still known for the Jungle Book, but at the same time, many people remember his shameful poem about white man's burden. And yeah, that, there is a complexity in our approach to writers or philosophers or politicians of previous centuries, and we should treat them in a very complex way.
Well, Mikhail, I don't honestly think there's a better way to end the podcast than right there. I mean, that was just fantastic, and in every way, War and Punishment is a fantastic vouch to that. And really, as I said at the top of the episode, everything you're doing right now is not only fantastic, but is really putting a voice out there that is really necessary in this time, one that I know people in Ukraine, people in Russia, and people around the world really appreciate. So thank you for that. As for War and Punishment, out everywhere now, it will be linked below, whether on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, doesn't matter. It'll be linked below. Make sure to go check out the book. Give it a read through. I already went through it. It's fantastic. Mikhail, if you want to shout out any of your other books or maybe social media sites.
Thank you, Reid. That was a very pleasant conversation. Yeah, I do think that this book would be very helpful for many people. And I hope that it's not my last book, because that's only the beginning of the job, that the work that I consider to be very important.
I hope so as well. And when the next one comes out, feel free to message me. We'll get another episode.
Great. Thank you so much.
Awesome, thank you. Man. Thank you. Have a good one.
Thank you.